The Monologue.
I'm told that starting right now, right this moment in Seattle, the city is going to impose its 72-hour parking law, one that they got rid of during COVID, which made sense. You're supposed to move your car at least once every 72 hours, or you get a ticket and then you get towed. The reason why they killed that law, or at least stopped enforcing it during COVID, was because people were ordered to stay home. Thus, they were trying to do what was best to keep people in the home. But now they're saying they're going to enforce it. On the one hand, I want to say, again, kudos where kudos are due to Mayor Bruce Harrell, who is going to enforce, or says he's going to enforce this. The Seattle Department of Transportation put out a release on Friday afternoon, which is because it's controversial, to the pro-homeless groups out there that claim to be advocating on behalf of the homeless, but really just making it easy for them to continue to be homeless. They put it out on Friday because they didn't want it to see a lot of attention. So I waited till Monday to talk about it, even though I could have easily talked about it on Friday. Kudos to them for doing this. They say public streets are not an appropriate place for long-term vehicle storage. And they're, of course, 100% true. They're accurate here, right? A public space supposed to be shared by the community, and people abuse it by just keeping their broken down car, some of whom live out of them, and just hang on to that spot forever, making it impossible for people who are just trying to get a parking spot so they can get to work on time, or to stop spending so much time looking for parking so they can get home and spend time with their kids. And it's being abused. So Seattle Public Utilities leads the RV remediation program. They do assessments of areas with five or more RVs in one location. They prioritize them for cleanup. But before then, they will say, hey, we'll give you the shelter that you need, but you got to say yes. We give you 72 hours notice. Up until now, there haven't really been any sweeps or impounding of these RVs. I think this is very clearly moving us in the right direction. Whether or not it's going to be truly enforced versus just threatening enforcement is yet to be seen. But this is very clearly a step in the right direction, because we've seen, and I was in the South Park neighborhood yesterday, and some of the some streets are completely overtaken by broken down cars and RVs, completely overtaken. Now, South Park is it's a little bit of an interesting neighborhood in that not all of it is residential. And so it's not hurting so many people as it would be if it was in, you know, downtown or in Eastlake, which is where we're located. I just wonder whether or not this is a threat to take this administration seriously, or if it's really going to be imposed. And when you do impose it, where do you start? I mean, when you think about Seattle as a whole and how often communities are impacted by this, where do you start? And wherever it is you start, that's obviously beneficial to the people who live there or nearby or visit a lot or work near there. But then you just get a whole bunch of people on your case from neighborhoods that are impacted by this saying, hey, what about us? What about us? What about us? We saw some of those complaints out of Georgetown. We saw those complaints out of Ballard. Hey, you're cleaning things up in downtown Seattle or near South Lake Union, but what about us here in Lake City? It becomes that kind of issue. But if they're attacking the problem in the communities, community by community, and they're doing so with a public-facing campaign, just telling everyone, hey, here's our plan, here's what we're doing, then I do think that this very clearly is a positive. I'm just going to wait for that first RV to actually get impounded before we celebrate this as a win.
The interview.
Oh, Mr. I Abide by the Law, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, is trying to get protections for out-of-state abortion providers who get caught up in criminal prosecutions for abiding by their pro-choice, pro-abortion position in states that might outlaw it after Roe v. Wade gets overturned. Joining me on the line with her reaction is State Representative Michelle Caldier, our friend, a Republican from Gig Harbor. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Jason.
There's some irony coming from Bob Ferguson, who constantly complained about how Donald Trump breaks the law, doesn't regard the law, which in large part was just nonsense talking points. But now he's saying we should disregard the laws of other states.
Oh, Absolutely. And the thing is, too, is that we don't know what happened in each of those cases.
Exactly.
So to have like a blanket approach to just saying, hey, you broke the law in your state, come on over to ours and we'll just ignore all of that so you can practice in our state. I mean, that's insane to me.
Yeah. If this is an abortion provider who acts in the third trimester, it conducts a partial birth abortion or a post-birth abortion, which is now apparently a thing for some Democrats to support, although a small group of them. We're supposed to just say, come on over to Washington State and we're not going to judge you by that? Really?
Oh, absolutely. And you also got to realize, too, that in our state, a nurse practitioner or a physician's mm-hmm. assistant, they can perform surgical abortions without having any prior training. And very few physicians in our country actually graduate with any sort of clinical abortion care at all. So who knows what happened in those circumstances? And in our state, up until birth, if the child is deemed that they will not survive or if it impacts the mother's life, that you can perform a surgical abortion up until delivery. And there are many complications that can happen. You can perforate the uterus, you can leave a portion of the baby and have an infection that can kill the mother. I mean, there's a lot of complications that happen. And I find it hard to believe that in those cases that a woman went in to get an abortion and everything went great and somehow they decided to file a complaint. Usually complaints arise in medical care when something goes wrong. And I'm interested to find out what happened there. The other piece, too, is that in our state, you can have an abortion at any age, which a lot of people do not agree with, you know, without parental consent. And so who knows if they were performing care on small children as well.
Well, that might actually give them extra points in Washington State, right? I mean, the way that abortion rights are considered here, that would get them extra points.
It is insane to me. And the other piece, too, is that it was not just his letter was not just for the abortion care, but it was also for gender affirming care, which children in our state can have done at age 13. So
again, without parental consent, but the parents would have
exactly.
to pay for it.
Yep, exactly. And I think this is virtue signaling on their side. And I think it's dangerous. I do not want providers into our state that have not only performed things illegally, but also more than likely than not have had complications with those procedures. I think that that's wrong.
Where do you think all this is going to end for Washington State?
So I think that's the hard part, is because this is all, in my opinion, all political. You know, really the Democrats have done a very poor job in Olympia, and Republicans are likely to pick up some seats. I think that this may tip, you know, the Roe versus Wade debate may tip things in swing districts like mine, which is in the 26th. And they're going to use that to their advantage as much as possible, because really at the end of the day, you know, in the event that Roe versus Wade gets overturned, Washington State will stay the same. You know, I seriously doubt that will change in the near future. I think the Democrats know that, but at the same time, I think that they also know that polling indicates that our state is supportive of some form of abortive care, and they want to use that to scare, you know, moderates into voting for them.
Well, only about 5,000 people showed up to the march over the weekend, and, you know, the folks on the left were claiming it would be tens of thousands of people because they overstate the level of interest in this particular issue in a state where there's no threat. So I think the Democrats are going to overplay their hand if they decide to lean in that direction. We've been talking with State Representative Michelle Caldier. She is representing the 26th Legislative District. So if you live there, make sure you're always backing Michelle. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for bringing attention to this huge problem that we have.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Now this.
The Monologue.
There's a new report out. Fox News has the exclusive. It's a report coming from a website, criticalrace.org. It monitors CRT in classrooms. Except in this case, it looked at prestigious medical schools or universities and found that at least 39 of the top 50 have some kind of mandatory student training around the concept or ideas related to CRT. University of Washington's Medical School is one of those listed. Now, we've talked about this in the past, this kind of garbage that they're putting on to kids. I would argue it's especially dangerous when you're putting this on to future doctors, because they're going to take those policies, that worldview that they are being indoctrinated with, and they're going to use it to frame their own practices. And when you are told things that are just nonsense, you end up getting policies, which we've seen in this country already, where we're going to give preferential medical treatment and services and access to communities of color. Meaning if you're a white guy and you come in, we're going to put you to the back of the line. Like, how is that appropriate? How about we just provide medical care for everybody equally? I know equal rights is a weird position now for the Democrats to accept, but Republicans are okay with it. They don't want to punish people. Now, the founder of Legal Insurrection spoke with Fox News and said the national alarm should be sounding over the radical racialization of medical school education. The swiftness and depth to which race-focused social justice education has penetrated medical schools reflects the broader disturbing trend in higher education. He also happens to be a clinical professor of law at Cornell. He's the one who founded criticalrace.org. They say the schools examined were based on the rankings by the U.S. rankings of America's top medical schools. And the findings show that they have, quote, some form of mandatory student training or coursework related to CRT. Why is CRT being taught in a medical school, if not to shape the way these doctors, when they become doctors, treat patients and come up with policies in hospitals? That's terrifying. That's absolutely terrifying, and it's unacceptable. This is the equivalent of going into a math class and then having the teacher talk about how math is racist because she views it, or he's viewing it through a CRT lens. CRT infects everything it touches, and nothing good comes of it. Nothing good comes of it. And it's being presented as if it is a fact, even though the whole concept of CRT as taught at a graduate school level is merely a theory. How do you know? Because it's in the name. Critical race theory. I don't want my doctor holding political position. And here's something that just drives me nuts. You should not know the political position either way, in either direction, of your doctor. And you go on Twitter, I'll probably do a story sometime this week, because I just saw this doctor over at a Swedish and Shoreline just taking remarkably ignorant but also hateful positions about cops. If you're a cop, would you ever feel comfortable going to a doctor who thinks you're a racist and a liar just because of your profession? No. So why are we doing this with kids? And unfortunately, we're now training them to bring politics into the doctor's office.
The interview.
Okay, we've got a national shortage on baby formula, in large part due to the supply chain crisis, meeting the Abbott factory getting closed down. It's getting a lot of parents desperate. Joining me in studio, not a desperate parent, but certainly someone who can explain how some people are getting help, Colleen O'Brien from our sister station, Cairo Radio. It turns out some folks are donating breast milk.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's been going on for a very long time. For about 40 years, donated breast milk has been used for NICU babies, preemie babies, for mothers whose supply takes longer than usual to come in, and they need that bridge supply to get them to the point where they can start feeding their own babies. So one option out there, if you cannot find the formula you need for your baby, is to contact the Rocky Mountain Children's Foundation in Colorado, and they can overnight you a supply of donated breast milk. This is all very safe. They screen the mothers, you give a blood test, they interview you, your OBGYN. You know, they have to make sure first that your child is thriving and okay, that the oversupply is the real deal, and then they have to screen out some medications that you shouldn't be taking when you're breastfeeding, and especially for other babies. So, you know, it's a good option if you can't find your formula. You could have milk the next morning and breast milk, which is certainly healthy, and you're getting those great antibodies and other things from donated breast milk. This is Jody Whitesell. She's with the Rocky Mountain Children's Foundation.
One of the biggest things that I wish could be dispelled is the idea that formula is the only option if parents aren't able to breastfeed for one reason or another. Breast milk has so many incredible nutritional benefits. It has a lot of bioactive properties. It's full of so many wonderful things that can help babies, whether they're premature or they're at home and healthy and thriving.
But Colleen, I'm told by Bette Midler that women who are complaining should just breastfeed them the kids themselves.
I know. Does Bette Midler have children? I don't follow her very closely.
If she does, it was decades and decades and decades removed from memory, which is just such a dumb tweet.
Maybe she had an easy time breastfeeding and lactating, but most women go through what can be a very traumatic journey to get to a comfortable place with their child, myself included, with two children. And then I interviewed an acquaintance of mine, Anna Eisenman. She's in Tacoma, and she had two distinct stories. Her first child, she really struggled.
I had a nearly impossible time nursing my first. I was very low supply. He had teeth at 3 months and was a biter. It just, like, the deck was stacked against us.
So she was getting ready to possibly use donated breast milk or formula for her second, but surprise!
When Arthur came along and all of a sudden I realized that I was producing this ridiculous excess, I mean, first I think I high-fived my husband. And I still, every time I pump, I'm just amazed at what my body is doing this time.
Anna is producing so much now that she started saving up the excess breast milk after feeding Arthur. She would pump and that would go into the deep freeze. So she's like, I'm not going to be able to use all of this. Mm-hmm. What can I do? She found the Rocky Mountain Children's Foundation and she called, got the screening, all of that. This was her result.
They called me about a week later to say that everything had been processed and donated. And I think it was 720 ounces that I had donated, a little over 5.5 gallons.
5.5 gallons.
That's a lot.
And let me remind people who may not lactate or don't have the experience that mostly bottles that you pump with are 4 or 8 ounces.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 4 or 8 ounces per breast at a time to save up 720 ounces and donate it to babies in need.
And it is, so the way that I always thought about breast milk in particular for the child was it was very specifically coming from his or her own mother, and there was an importance of that as far as, is that not the case?
Certainly.
Or at least it's not the only case.
It's not the only case, right? So certainly, like, breasts are magical when it comes to lactating, where the breast can actually, like, take in some of the saliva from the baby. And if your body as a mother detects a health issue in your child, you create the antibodies in your milk and then give that then back to your child. It's quite magical. So if you are able to breastfeed, if you go through it and you get it done, good for you, but you're still getting the antibodies. You're still getting the good stuff from another mother's milk.
But it's not as personalized.
Formulated, yes, but it's still it to the point that when my sister had an undersupply and I had an oversupply, we happened to have babies at the same time, she was like, well, hey, can I have some of yours? Because I'd love for them to get your immunity, too. So,
Your child wasn't jealous.
No, not at all.
Jealousy going on. That's my breast milk.
Yes, I had so much. But, you know, that's not the story for everyone. And I definitely want to make sure that I say that when we're talking about breast milk and how great it is for your baby, what I don't want to happen in this interview is for any mother out there who's only used formula or an adoptive parent, for them to feel shame, because women feel shame whether they're breastfeeding. Women feel shame if they are giving formula. There's just a lot of shame heaped onto women when it comes to feeding their babies.
Well,
I just want to present this.
Ironically applied in this case, because again, I know that, not to get too political here and then we'll wrap up, but you know, conservatives waging the war on women. And yet on this, I'm hearing most of this stuff from people like Bette Midler, who who's a hardcore liberal.
Just, it really surprises
me. It's just odd
me
to me.
But, you know, she's from a different generation, too. And I think
just
that
collar old.
That generation did not get the grace that women today might get, where there are so many options available to you. There are support groups for lactating women. So please, the Rocky Mountain Children's Health Foundation is a resource for you. They can overnight donate a breast milk.
How do people connect with them?
Just look it up online. Rocky Mountain Group. You can Google Milk Bank. And Tacoma General Hospital is who contracts mm-hmm. with this group, too. So you can also contact that hospital.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. For more information, check that out. Colleen O'Brien from Cairo News Radio. Thanks for stopping
Happy
by.
Happy to be here.
Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz has followed that into Taley's radio host in Seattle. He broke this story and joins us now.
Never shy of his opinion, Jason. Definitely letting you know how he feels about that.
Wow. You laid that down.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
Well, judging from the media coverage over the last day, you would think that the mass shooting in Buffalo was a direct result of Fox News and a culture of hate. In fact, maybe it was Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity or Laura Ingraham who was the actual shooter. That's how insane the coverage has been. Someone who gets paid to watch all the insane coverage and then call it out is my next guest, Curtis Houck, managing editor over at Newsbusters. Curtis, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, my friend. How are you?
I am doing fine. I am getting to the point of sheer annoyance where I'm just snapping at people because of how just awful some of this coverage mm-hmm. has been.
Yeah, no, I think this is a complete disaster, but it's so entirely predictable. We've been seeing this for years. You know, we're going to memory hold what happened in Waukesha. You know, we memory hold, you know, remember that subway shooting in New York City? The gunman there suggested he was pretty much a virulent racist who had issues with white people. And, you know, and yet in this case, the evil perpetuated on that, we're not actually going to look at what he actually said. We're going to blame Fox News. We're going to blame Tucker Carlson, even though, you know, he went again, you know, he attacked Fox News. And we have journalists in the White House press corps today, Jason, you know, demanding Karine Jean-Pierre launch a White House campaign against Tucker Carlson, that the White House make it a priority to go after Tucker Carlson, you know. And so we have really two tracks going on right now with the media coverage. We have that's trying to accuse conservatives writ large, which I should just say again, is not about Tucker Carlson. Yes, he is the main hate object at this point, but it is about conservative media. It's about anyone who's not in the liberal corporate complex whom they deem insufficient. They instead would much prefer people like Vox, who closed their offices today so people can all get grief counselors, even though they're nowhere even near Buffalo. And as far as we know, no one on staff was affected by it. We also have CBS doing what you're thinking is a lot of fear mongering, suggesting that nowhere is safe in American life. The fact, the mere act of existing right now mm-hmm. means puts you at risk for mass violence. Gayle King, you know, who makes at least $11 million a year, and whose best friend Oprah never left her house for over 300 days in her little island in Hawaii because of COVID fears, says that she doesn't feel safe going anywhere anymore because she's black and, you know, there's too many guns in this country. So, you know, a lot of fear mongering. It's very similar to the abortion crowd, all fear, whereas conservatives, we're living our lives.
Yeah. How odd is that? And what drives me nuts about this the most is, and I tweeted this out earlier today, I'm on the Faulkner Focus pretty much every single week, and every single appearance for the most part covers at least one crime story. And it's usually out of Chicago. It's usually of black victims, not white victims, of black victims. And we talk about that every single week. And yet the only time you hear any kind of crime story on CNN or MSNBC or in the New York Times or Washington Post when it involves guns is when you can politicize it. That's the only time that they cover this with any meaning. They basically ignored, outside of the first day, the incident in Waukesha. They ignored, for the most part, what you just said with the subway. Like, this is the consistency. They're not there ever talking mm-hmm. about Chicago gun violence, and yet Fox News is, but Fox is the enemy. Fox doesn't care about the victims.
And we even have a more recent story. We learned this afternoon that the gunman allegedly involved in the shooting at the Presbyterian Church in California was a Chinese man targeting the congregation because they were Taiwanese. So we also have another act of hate as well. Someone from China, someone who's Chinese ethnicity, going people who are Taiwan, from Taiwan. So that's another story that I think, you know, Drew Holden, among others, have pointed out that, yeah, this story is going to go away real fast because of that. You know, and we also, it doesn't help that, you know, also on CBS this morning, we had Benjamin Crump, who's already on the ground there. This guy is just one of the biggest racial arsonists in this country alongside Al Sharpton. He was complaining on air about the fact that police in Buffalo took the gunman alive. Why are we, you know, he was wondering, why are we taking him alive? Whereas black men are just mowed down by police somehow, in mass, when they face off or there's police encounter involving black men, that they're gunned down, but whereas white people survive, and that's somehow a problem. It's just this, again, just act of racial arson that is going to perpetuate, you know, divisions in our country, and they don't care.
They don't care. And that's the part that I think bothers me the most isn't necessarily just the gaslighting and the double standard and the hypocrisy. It's that they don't seem to care that in large part it comes off as if some of these folks, not all of them, but some of them seem as if they are waiting for any kind of tragedy. They're just waiting with these pre-written tweets that they can send out and create a new hashtag against Fox News or against Tucker or against Trump or against any Republican. It happens all the time. And yet again, when a tragedy occurs that they can't turn into a political argument, they will do the bare minimum of coverage and then they'll just move on.
Right. And there's not even exact evidence behind it. You know, the New York Times has their little story of going after Tucker Carlson from Nick Confessori, who wrote that three-part
MSNBC contributor.
Contributor. He has this line in his article about replacement theory and Tucker Carlson. It says, quote, measuring the extent of Mr. Carlson's influence in spreading replacement theory may be impossible, but the controversies around the host's use of replacement rhetoric appear to at least help drive public curiosity around the idea. So we don't have evidence of it, but we think it is. So we're going to say it anyway.
Exactly. And by the way, Tucker does not push.
That's not how journalism is supposed to work.
Yeah, and Tucker doesn't push the great replacement theory. He's never talked about that. He's talked about demographic shifts, like literally every other news organization, like the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN. And, you know, you mentioned Drew Holden from, what is he with, the Observer?
Free Beacon.
Like, he pointed out today how that works. All of this stuff was not invented with Tucker Carlson.
Right. And, you know, the great Vince Galanese has been sharing a clip of Tucker Carlson from the last couple of years, I believe, where he said, quote, slavery and Jim Crow were immoral precisely because they punished people for how they were born. And wealth, appearance, ancestry could play no role in the eyes of the law. Oh my gosh, that sounds really racist to me, huh? You know?
Yeah, how controversial.
No, it doesn't at all.
Yeah, how controversial.
It is controversial then.
And what drives me nuts, and we'll leave it at this, I'll give you the last word, is that the same folks who are now complaining about rhetoric and saying, rhetoric from Fox News is causing this, are the same people who call all of their political opponents fascists and Nazis. They're the ones claiming that Republicans want to kill women. They're the ones claiming that we're one step closer, if not to the inevitability of A Handmaid's Tale. They're the people who are telling us that we all need to chill with the rhetoric. Right.
Yeah. The level of just insane, or we also have had, you know, during healthcare debates in previous years about Republicans are going to kill you. Ed Schultz would say that they want you dead. And I just think the last point is, I think it's interesting that, yes, we're discussing rhetoric and going after Tucker Carlson. Why? Because New York's gun laws didn't stop this person. They had an illegal magazine and they were somehow able to legally purchase their firearm despite New York having those red flag laws that the left demanded all these states pass in the wake of the Parkland shooting. And yet he made threats at his school. He had to be taken by court order to be given a mental health evaluation. Mm-hmm. And he passed, so he was able to purchase those guns. So all those precious laws that the left wants didn't work. So maybe that's why, in some respects, we're looking at rhetoric and Tucker Carlson being the problem instead of guns.
We need more laws. What those laws are, we don't know, but they'll be more effective this time around, we promise. We've been talking with Curtis Houck. He's the managing editor over at Newsbusters. Check out Newsbusters. It's a great resource. Newsbusters.org, newsbusters.org. Curtis, thank you so much for stopping by as always. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason.
Now this.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rants. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rants is in focus now.
Jason Rants, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
Tomorrow it is primary day for Oregon and Idaho. I'll focus a little bit on Idaho maybe tomorrow because you've got an interesting race between the incumbent governor and the lieutenant governor who's kind of a pain in his backside. But Oregon is really interesting because I don't expect to see some sort of meaningful red wave in Oregon, but it is curious to see how some of the races will end up shaping up, because one of the races that is very curious is the one to potentially replace the challenge to Joanne Hardesty, who is a council member with the Portland City Council. They don't go by those titles, but whatever. We're going to use our own titles. And she's being challenged because of the fact that, hey, guess what? You are a little cray-cray. You're really, really far to the left. You are a socialist, anti-police, Shama Sawant wannabe. And in a lot of ways, she's actually worse. She's actually worse than Shama Sawant. Someone who is really, again, same kind of thing, where she's been really meaningful in enacting all sorts of policies that have put people's lives in danger. The policies that she supports that have directly led to less police officers within the Portland Police Department. Policies that have very clearly led not only to this exodus, but have emboldened criminals. You know, she's been responsible. She's been responsible. And so now she's being challenged. And she's being challenged by, they're not right-wingers, but they're certainly closer to the center and certainly more from the right way of thinking from an Oregon perspective, from a Portland perspective. One of them is Vadim Mazursky, and the other is Rene Gonzalez. Now, Vadim Mazursky, again, pretty centrist. They're both Democrats, but pretty centrist. He's someone who has been previously an administrative law judge, and he's taking a very pro-business perspective to the point where a political action committee was set up to help him, at least in the short term, get into the primary season, because he's going up against Rene Gonzalez. She's a lawyer. He owns a software company. He's gotten a whole bunch of pretty significant endorsements from the local media there, including the editorial board of the Oregonian. Now, both of them pretty much say the same thing on the issues that we've been focused on here in Washington, which is we need to get serious about enforcing homelessness laws or laws impacting homelessness, meaning, hey, you can't just camp out wherever it is you want to camp out. And we need to clean up our streets, literally clean up our streets, not only giving police more officers and more resources, which are positions that they both take, which, by the way, they also point out needing to support the cops more vocally, which, again, if you're guessing these trends, kind of serious here. But for the most part, they're talking also about just cleaning up the trash everywhere, because I don't know when was the last time you went to Portland. I don't wish it upon my, well, I wish it upon my worst. That's how bad it is. I do wish it upon my worst enemy because I'm petty. So I do wish it upon them. Now, for Hardesty's role, you know, she's been consistent. She is like Shama Sawant, where you know exactly where she stands on the issues. They're crazy fringe beliefs, but she's exactly where she stands. Will she have a hard time maintaining her position? Because in a perfect world, she doesn't even make it to the general. She's going to make it to the general. Who will she take over? Who will she take on? Well, which of the moderates will she take on? And will we see a little bit of how that wave, that red wave, in this case, a centrist sort of purple wave, will impact Portland, which is obvious, that's their Seattle. And if Portland goes in one direction, away from the nonsense, boy, can we expect a true red wave across the country. Now you've got on the governor's race, Kate Brown can't seek re-election because of term limits, so she's done. She's out. And you're likely going to get a Democrat nominee who ends up taking the whole position. But the question is, which one do you get? You've got I think you got 19 Republicans running. But on the Democratic side, you've got two pretty prominent campaigns, two prominent candidates. And you base that based on sort of name recognition. They've got that former House Speaker there, Tina Kotek. She's very, very, very far to the left. But then you've got the state treasurer in Tobias Reid. Now, the state treasurer is not at all a Republican. He's not at all a Republican. He's pretty much a progressive Democrat. However, in his role as treasurer, he's been more centrist and moderate than anything, which you can't say for the former House Speaker, Tina Kotek, who is very, very far to the left. She's the one responsible for raising the minimum wage to a point that a lot of folks can't honestly run a business, getting rid of single-family zoning because single-family zoning is racist or some nonsense, putting in place more taxes. She had a big business tax, a new business tax, and it's supposed to go to education that is not really all that effective in Oregon, unfortunately. And at the same time, she is seen as being pretty abusive in her past positions and using her role to push through a whole bunch of policies, even leaving lawmakers on the left saying this is not the right way to do it. This is the wrong way to go about it. Then you've got Reid, who is saying, "Hey, I'm more moderate. I'm the business friendly candidate. I want to work with people of all sorts of political stripes." So in tone, it's also much different for him. I don't know who's going to win either of these, whether we're talking about the governor's race or the Portland commissioner's race. But wherever it goes, this could be something of a bellwether state. Maybe. Again, if it goes the direction of more crazy, well, that's Oregon. We write it off as, well, that's Oregon. If it goes against the type, same way I don't look at hardcore red states and say, oh, look, they voted for the red candidate. No, that's what they do. That is what red states do, the same way blue states put in, you know, Democrats. The question becomes, will this be a harbinger of things to come if they play against type? And that's what I'm paying attention to.
The last rants.
And with that, just my last rants. Can we chill with the word policing? Because it is driving me up a wall, and I'm done with it. I came very close today just on Twitter, just ripping into someone who I'm sure is an actual fan based on his Twitter feed, and I recognize the screen name, but I said something today on Twitter about gun violence, and the context was very clear. It's about violence involving guns taking people's lives. And every so often, I'll get the response by someone, it's not gun violence, it's people violence. I don't hear anyone talking about knife violence or alcohol violence, and he lists a whole bunch of other things. First of all, I do know about knife violence. We use that term when it applies as well. You know exactly what I'm saying. Exactly what I'm saying. There's no confusion whatsoever. And when I get those kinds of tweets or text messages or emails or whatever it happens to be, they go, oh, it's not gun violence. Yeah, it's gun violence. The difference is when talking about the gun violence, I don't ignore the people behind it or the policies behind it. And that's how you talk about things. If it was unclear as to what I was talking about, that's one thing. But word policing the same way people say, well, we don't say pregnant mothers. We say pregnant people or people with ovaries or whatever. Like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to accept it from the left. And I'm definitely not going to accept it from the right because we're supposed to know better. So chill out with the word policing. It's kind of driving me nuts. And if I see you writing something I disagree with, I'm going to police. I'm kidding. That's the last rant.